DiscerningHearts.com presents The Way of Life, Reflections on the Teachings of Blessed John Paul II with Dr. Carson Holloway. Dr. Holloway is an assistant professor of political science at the University of Nebraska at Omaha and a former William E. Simon visiting fellow in Princeton University's James Madison Program in American Ideals and Institutions. He's the author of Magnanimity and Statesmanship, The Right Darwin, Evolution, Religion, and the Future of Democracy, All Shook Up, Music, Passion, and Politics, and The Way of Life, John Paul II and the Challenge of Liberal Modernity, on which this series is based. The Way of Life, Reflections on the Teachings of Blessed John Paul II with Dr. Carson Holloway. I'm your host, Chris McGregor. In this final segment, why don't we just recap for folks exactly what liberal modernity is, and then we'll talk about Evangelium Vitae.
Yeah. By liberal modernity in the book, I mean a philosophic movement and a political movement of the last, say, 200 or 300 years, 400 years, that really tried to remake politics. I mean, ancient political thought and Catholic political thought, medieval political thought was focused more on the community, and political life is organized toward the highest good for human beings. And you get this radical turn at the beginning of the modern era, which generates what I've called liberal modernity, which kind of reorients politics around, I would say, the rights of the self-interested individual. It elevates the idea of individual rights and elevates the idea of the individual as a self-interested actor. So it kind of really turns things around. It contends that community is not a natural phenomenon, but something that self-interested individuals create through artificial means like contracts. And, in fact, in some cases, and we've talked about this before, you can even see this individualism seeping into the understanding of the family, which we would regard more as a natural institution than simply a constructed one. But anyway, that's what I mean by liberal modernity. In some politics organized around the individual rights of the self-interested individual, let's say.
And for John Paul II, this really was the harbinger of the culture of death, mm-hmm. this movement.
That's the argument that I make in the book, that without perhaps intending it from the beginning, probably certainly without intending it from the beginning, liberal modernity has a certain weakness in the direction of the culture of death. And to sum up that argument, in Evangelium Vitae, the Pope argues that the culture of death is underpinned by a certain kind of individualism, hedonism, moral relativism, and all of these things are characteristic of liberal modernity at its origins. I've already mentioned the focus on the individual and the sense that obligations to others exist only if we consent to them, right? Certainly in Thomas Hobbes, way back at the beginning of liberal modernity, who we talked about before, there's a forthright acknowledgement that human beings are fundamentally, materialistically self-interested, they're hedonistic, and therefore any moral rules that are invented for society have to be based upon kind of an acknowledgement of that materialism and hedonism. And it's these things that the Pope in Evangelium Vitae says do lead to the culture of death. And I think the easiest way to sum up that argument would be to say that if human beings are that way by nature, if they're self-interested and hedonistic, then they're going to experience any kind of moral rules that are imposed upon them as a burden and an irritation, and they're going to try to get out from under them to the extent that they can. The problem with liberal modernity is it doesn't really provide any kind of rich account, like the gospel does, about why it is that in serving others and in respecting the rights of others, we're also respecting ourselves. I think liberal modernity, with its individualism and hedonism, makes service to others into kind of a drag, so to speak. It's something that you may have to do to make your way through society, but it's never something that is really all that intrinsically good. And that lends a kind of instability to morality that the Pope suggests is very dangerous, because if it's something that can be dispensed with, then it's going to be dispensed with first in relation to the weak and the vulnerable and those who cost more and who demand more of us. Precisely those who most need love are the ones who are not going to get it, on this theory, I think was the argument.
That reminds me of a quote, Dr. Holloway, from the late writer Flannery O'Connor, who said that the truth does not change according to our ability to stomach it.
Yes, I think that's a very apt quote in a way, because it might be the case that the philosophic founders of liberal modernity had lost their ability to stomach the truth. They no longer wanted to look to God as the supreme good. They wanted to organize society around something humbler, or, you know, less lofty in a sense. Again, this self-interested individual. And we can even sympathize with that to a certain extent. I mean, the demands placed upon human beings by the true morality are serious demands, and they're hard to meet. But that doesn't mean they're not true demands, as Flannery O'Connor suggests. And it also doesn't mean that we don't get into deeper trouble by turning away from those demands than we get into by trying to pursue them. And I think that's, again, what my interpretation is. That's what the Pope thinks about liberal modernity. You know, one way of characterizing it is that, and I've heard other scholar of political philosophy, Leo Strauss, put it this way, that they tried to build on low but solid ground. You know, that, in other words, the pursuit of the supreme good turned out to be so controversial and so difficult that they thought, well, let's just build society on the basis of things that nobody can argue with, like the rights of the individual to pursue his own materialistic self-interest. That's not very inspiring, but on the other hand, nobody would disagree with it. Well, I think my interpretation of the Pope's implicit critique of liberal modernity is that the low ground turns out to be not so solid. It's kind of a moral swamp in which you sort of sink into deeper depths of misery and tyranny. And we shouldn't forget that the Pope suggests that the ultimate outcome of the culture of death is tyranny, outright tyranny, or the most manifest injustices. And I think, as I argue in the book, that liberal modernity has a weakness in the direction not only of the culture of death, but of outright tyranny, too.
Yeah. And that's what we've looked at over the last several segments, looking at the philosophical foundations of liberal modernity, and that it is flawed, mm-hmm. and that you can see the consequences of that flawed thought in the occurrences of history, mm-hmm. particularly during the period of the Enlightenment, mm-hmm. when it was integrated into political systems, yeah. political governings, for example, in revolutionary France, as opposed to revolutionary United States.
Right, which was also influenced by the Enlightenment, but also powerfully influenced by the Christian tradition, which the French revolutionaries seem to be more interested in simply repudiating. And I'm glad you brought up the Enlightenment, because one way of kind of lending credibility to my interpretation, I think, is to appeal to the Pope's last book, which is called Memory and Identity. It's a series of interviews that he did that was published the month he died. And in a way, what I've done in my book is to construct what I think is his critique of liberal modernity based on drawing out the arguments from Evangelium Vitae and applying them to the kind of landmark works of liberal modernity. Somebody could say, well, that's kind of speculative. You know, did the Pope ever say this flat out himself? Well, not quite, but I think he came very close in Memory and Identity, where he talks about the Enlightenment and says that it is an evil and a source of evils. Now, all the thinkers that I've talked about in the preceding programs, like Thomas Hobbes, John Locke, David Hume, even America, to the extent that it's a product of the Enlightenment, or of those philosophers, rather, I should say, all these liberal modern thinkers and the American regime are in some ways products of the Enlightenment as a movement. Nobody really denies that, I don't think. And what the Pope says in Memory and Identity is, again, well, the Enlightenment was fundamentally flawed, and it leads to disastrous practical consequences. He speaks of it in the context as kind of a cause of what he calls the ideologies of evil, by which he means not just the French Revolution, but also the disastrous, totalitarian, murderous ideologies of the 20th century. I take Memory and Identity as kind of indicating that the Pope really did think hard about the origins of the modern world in the Enlightenment, and he really did find fundamental problems there, so that we could say his thought is a very deep, radical critique of the modern world. And we can ask, you know, what's the problem with the Enlightenment? He indicates in Memory and Identity it's the same problem that Evangelium Vitae suggests is present in liberal modernity. It's the rejection of love, you know, the rejection of the idea that we have a deep responsibility for other human beings. In Memory and Identity, John Paul II says that even though there were more moderate and more extreme versions of the Enlightenment, it was all based upon, he says, a rejection of what Europe had become as a result of evangelization. It was fundamentally anti-Christian in his view. You know, it's not to say that it was totally atheistic. He's very careful, I think, in Memory and Identity. He says, you know, a lot of these Enlightenment thinkers were like the folks that St. Paul encountered in Athens. You know, they believed in God as some kind of supreme being, but they didn't want to hear about the gospel. You know, they didn't believe in the God of love. And this gets us into all the same problems that he talks about in Evangelium Vitae. He says, well, the Enlightenment rejected the God of love, it rejected Christ, it rejected the duty to love, but at the same time it saw, well, you have to have some kind of morality to have a working society, so it decided to adopt a morality based upon hedonistic individualism and self-interest. But that is precisely the kind of morality that can then be dispensed with when one is encountered with burdensome or problematic individuals, or individuals or peoples that you think are burdensome or problematic. And so again, he kind of draws that connection between the Enlightenment and the totalitarianisms of the 20th century. Another point he makes that I think is worth mentioning in this connection is, he says, characteristic of the Enlightenment to kind of demote God to the status of an idea. He harks back to St. Thomas Aquinas, for whom God was truly the supreme good and the source of all being and all intelligibility. And the Pope says in Memory and Identity, well, its characteristic of the Enlightenment is to follow Descartes with, you know, I think, therefore I am, to radically doubt everything and to begin from man himself as a thinking being, which tends to downgrade God to the status of an idea in man's mind rather than a real being giving rise to everything else. And as a result, he says, the Enlightenment tends to view man as kind of alone in the universe and in need of creating his own morality, rather than having one already created at the same time as he was created. And that, again, leads to the possibility of very terrible abuses. You know, if we can create our own morality, we can create one that exempts the people we want to exempt.
Yeah, at best, we end up with a God that is a distant God, the great clockmaker who sets the clocks in motion and then just lets it take off and clicking down time. It also reminds me that really, dare I say it, awful song that Bette Midler did years ago where God is watching us from a distance.
Which
is really bad theology.
Yeah, I mean, that's a good
in
point.
Essence, in a, from a Christian perspective, because God is not at a distance in the gospel of life. He is present in each person.
It's right here.
and it's been manifested in every way. And to deny God's interaction really is at the heart of the philosophical foundational problem of liberal modernity.
Yeah, I think that's right.
And the importance of each person's dignity, the value of the human dignity of each created soul.
Yeah, that's a good point. And certainly the theology based on the New Testament is very important there too. I mean, we can speak of, that's a good point. The Greeks believed in some kind of God as a highest principle that lent intelligibility to the universe, but they didn't quite fasten upon this idea that every individual human being is created in the image and likeness of God. And certainly they didn't have what I think the Pope thinks is essential, is in addition to that, the belief that, well, human beings have been redeemed by God, right? Not only did he create them in his image and likeness, he found that worthwhile enough to suffer and die for, right? Which really adds increased weight to the idea that every individual has a certain dignity that is inviolable. And this is the truth about human life, according to the Pope, and that also is what makes the Enlightenment an evil, right? Evil here, not in the sense of a moral evil, but like a metaphysical evil in the sense that he appeals to the kind of traditional Thomistic definition of evil as the absence of a good that is due, right? It's in the Catholic tradition, evil is never a positive thing. It's always just something's missing. And he says the Enlightenment's an evil because it has neglects or rejects this idea that there is a God of love. And this is a truth about our situation that we crave to know and ought to know, and we don't know the truth about ourselves until we do know that, and so it's evil in that sense. It's something's missing that should be missing, and then that does lead to the moral evils that we discussed a few minutes ago. When we don't understand the truth about ourselves, we can't understand the truth about our duties to others, And we're going to miss those duties and misunderstand them.
Because from what I understand, you say in the liberal modernity, the first priority is the self.
That's basically it. I think starting with Thomas Hobbes, and it's very clear in Hobbes, I think in some ways he's more ruthless and consistent than the later liberal thinkers who follow him. There's this sense that, well, we just have to concede to the fact that, or we have to give in to the fact that most human beings, most of the time, are fundamentally self-interested, even selfish, individualistic beings that are not interested in any kind of higher duty or higher call to love, especially, right? And he's very clear on that, saying, look, that's the way it is, and we're going to have to organize our society around that. The later ones are more moderate and try to qualify it with these various humanitarian elements, but because they admit so much of what Hobbes says, it always renders it kind of an unstable mixture. I think what the Pope is saying is, both in Memory and Identity and in Evangelium Vitae, is that we really have to rethink and ultimately reject this Enlightenment and liberal supposition that human beings are fundamentally self-interested, hedonistic beings. And again, I would say the Pope is certainly a realist about human nature. He would admit we have to concede a lot of influence to original sin and human depravity, but that's not the deepest truth about what we are. I mean, Hobbes, and anybody who's skeptical about human nature is on to some kind of truth about human beings, but that's not the deepest ground of our nature. Rather, the deepest ground is our creation in the image and likeness of God, which means fundamentally we're oriented toward the good, not toward ourselves.
Also, it goes back to that fundamental commandments that Jesus gave us, to love God with all our heart and soul, and mm-hmm. and to love our neighbor as we love ourselves.
Right.
St. Therese would take that even a step further in a way, that she would say that beyond just loving our neighbor as we would love ourselves, that we need to love them as Jesus loves them.
Yes, that's right.
And that's the real, isn't that the hook?
That's right. And Jesus himself says ultimately, near the end, I believe, love others as I have loved you.
Mm-hmm.
And it's very important to bring that up. I'm glad you did, because you see, from the standpoint of liberal modernity or Enlightenment thought, that would be a deeply alienating moral teaching because it's so contrary to what we are, right? I mean, to put it simply, we don't want to love others. We don't want to love God. We want to love ourselves, and that's it. And the Pope is saying, look, that's just, if you believe that, it's going to lead to all kinds of disastrous consequences, because there'll be no limit to the evils that might be done to those for whom an obligation to them can't be reconciled with your own self-interest. And on top of it, it's not true, right? That's not the truth about human beings. Again, yes, we have these frailties. Yes, we are self-interested, but that's not the whole truth about us, and we'll never have a decent and just society, nor will we be happy as individuals unless we understand the full truth about ourselves.
And that is one of the reasons why this discussion is so important, reflecting on Evangelium Vitae, the Gospel of Life by John Paul II, because when liberal modernity is discussed in a classroom and it's just a philosophical thought discussion, that's one thing. But once it penetrates into a political system and into the governing of individuals and of a society as a whole, then the ramifications can become life and death ramifications.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think that's what the Pope's driving at in Evangelium Vitae when he talks about the culture of death. It is a culture. It's not just a theory. It's a set of it has a theoretical element, and it does have these origins in philosophic theories, but it becomes a culture in the sense of a set of presuppositions about the way life is that is widespread and held by everybody. And so, yeah, it's a serious challenge we face. I reflected on that when I first started work on this project. I mean, in a way, it's sobering. What the Pope is saying is that the culture of death is not just some wrong turn that took place in 1973 in Roe v. Wade or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
The culture was prepared for that, in a way, over a long period of time. And again, I can't say it better, I don't think, than by saying that, you know, we have a deeply individualistic, hedonistic culture. And that's something that has to be resisted. And we have to set up examples of the opposite. I think that's why he calls for a civilization of love.
And to look back on revolutionary France and say, well, that's not us. That's not who we are for the United States. That's why it was important to take a look at de Tocqueville to say, okay, no, at that time you weren't revolutionary France. You had a structure in that kept you from taking that path down what would later become the time of the terror in France, you had a structure, and it was the Christian ethic. It was the Judeo-Christian lifestyle, at the very least. And today the danger is if we pull that out of that structure, if we piece by piece begin to remove that, our slide might not be as dramatic in a time sequence, but it can be just as disastrous.
Yeah, and Tocqueville thought that American democracy worked out better and more decently precisely because it was religious. And he thought religion was really, well, here's the problem, I think, as Tocqueville understood it. Democracy is not a bad thing, but it does have tendencies toward tyranny and despotism precisely because it has tendencies towards individualism and hedonism. And we kind of talked about those arguments earlier. And the counterbalance to those individualistic and hedonistic tendencies is religion. And so Tocqueville said flat out in his great work, Democracy in America, there's kind of left-wing atheists in Europe who think that the only thing wrong with America is its religion. I'm telling you, that's exactly what makes it work. And you don't understand freedom, and you don't understand religion if you don't understand how they can go together and found a great society like America. The problem is, Tocqueville also points out that democracy has tendencies to kind of erode the belief in and seriousness about God. You know, religion is the antidote to its difficulties, but it also tends to distance itself from religion because there's kind of a worldliness about democracy. I mean, democracies tend to be very prosperous, and there's a lot of activity. There's just a lot of things to distract us from God, which is why it's essential, Tocqueville says, for responsible leaders in democracy to keep recalling the minds of the people to spiritual things. And then that's why I say in the book that I think in a way you could say that the preeminent Tocquevillian statesman of the 20th century would be John Paul II, because he's doing exactly what the Pope's doing exactly what Tocqueville would say must be done for democracies. Call them back to God.
And it's important to remember that Tocqueville was placing the emphasis not just on religion, but on the Christian religion.
That's right.
The tendency today might be to say that democracy can work in any culture with any type of religion, and that could be problematic given the nature of the religion.
Yeah, I mean, and Tocqueville is interesting and hard to pin down because he writes, as he says, a social scientist. He says, you know, societies don't have anything to gain from the next life. It's only individuals who do. So he does kind of admit, he says explicitly, that it's possible for a society to have and to benefit even from a false religion. In fact, kind of maybe hypothetically, he says, you know, for example, it's very important that people believe in the spirituality of the soul. And he says, to that extent, even belief in the transmigration of souls, you know, like reincarnation into animals, would be better for people, even though he kind of indicates that's an absurd belief. That would be better than believing that the soul is nothing and that it's extinguished with death. So there's a certain kind of flexibility or even relativism there from the standpoint of just social analysis. But then he does say in another passage that it's indispensable that, that in the nations of the West, Christianity be preserved at all costs. And I think that's in part because, for, well, a couple of reasons you could make that. One is kind of on historical, sociological grounds. He says Christianity is the religion of the West. And because democracy has this tendency to undermine religious belief, if you let go of the religion you inherited, you're not sure you're ever going to get another one, right? That any other one will ever be credible to the people. So if you've inherited a religion, you want to hang on to it. Now, he says other things, though, that are more fundamental and philosophic, I think. At one point in Democracy in America, he talks about how in the ancient world, the default position was aristocratic, and there was no appreciation of human equality at all. And he says, it's a very striking phrase, Jesus Christ had to come down to the earth in order for people to understand that all human beings are equal and similar. Now, that gives a lot of credit to Christianity for the origins of democracy and the origins of a belief in the dignity of human beings as human beings. And I think on those grounds, too, we ought to be pretty careful to preserve Christianity in the developed nations of the West, just as Tocqueville says and just as a lot of people are not doing right now.
Again, as a reminder, Alexei de Tocqueville was Catholic.
Yes, he was.
So just had to put that in there.
That should be in there.
closing thoughts on this particular series, Carson, and is there hope here for us?
I hope there is hope, and I think there is hope, because if, as I believe, the Pope is correct about human nature, then an individualistic, hedonistic culture will never be fully satisfying to human beings. No matter what the deforming impulses of the culture are, there will always be people looking for more, because there really is more that their nature is yearning for. And another point that I make at the very end of my book is that I hope people won't conclude from this critique I've drawn out of the Pope's thought that he's simply an enemy of the modern West or an enemy of liberal modernity, because I don't think he presents himself that way, and I don't think he thinks of himself that way. I think he thinks of himself as a friendly critic of the developed West. And here again, I draw an analogy to Tocqueville. De Tocqueville said in Democracy in America, "I'm so critical of democracy not because I'm its adversary, but because I want it to work out as well as possible." You know, the most valuable person is neither an enemy nor a flattering friend, but a candid friend who will tell you what your flaws are. And I think that's the spirit in which the Pope approaches even liberal modernity. He's aware that there are good things about it. He's aware that its focus on the individual has a certain power and even goodness, especially in contrast to, you remember, the popes have a long memory, especially in contrast to the feudalism that we left behind. I mean, the feudal past was not perfect or to be idealized either, because feudalism has this preoccupation with rank and hierarchy, according to which it's kind of the idea of the dignity of the person, the human person, as opposed to the dignity of the nobleman, is kind of alien, right? And so that was problematic. And to that extent, I think the Pope thinks that the Enlightenment did a good thing in focusing attention on man, understood simply in terms of human nature. But it made a mistake when it turned away from God, right? Mm-hmm. We need to turn to man, understood as the creature of God, not turn to man and away from God. And so I think the Pope would say, you know, you should pay attention to my thought, because I'm not simply an enemy. I'm trying to make modernity better. I'm not trying to reject it. But after all, liberal modernity, I think, is sincere in its desire to respect human dignity. The Pope's point is it just can't reliably do it because it's got its theology and its anthropology wrong, you know. It doesn't understand God and doesn't understand human nature. And so if it's really going to achieve its noble aspirations to respect the dignity of everybody, it's going to have to return to this biblical and Catholic tradition that the Pope offers. And so I would hope that even though his critique is a deep one, that the proponents of liberal modernity wouldn't simply dismiss him, but listen to him, which I think would be fitting, because liberal modernity often boasts about its openness. Well, if you're going to be open, you got to listen to even those who criticize you, and even the Pope.
I take it a step further and follow the example of the Blessed Virgin Mary, as recorded in the Gospels, as she took all these things and pondered them in her heart.
That would be a good thing to do.
That, I agree. The Way of Life, John Paul II and the Challenge of Liberal Modernity by Dr. Carson Holloway. Thank you so much, Dr. Holloway, for your fine work.
Thanks very much for having me on the show.
You've been listening to The Way of Life, Reflections on the Teachings of Blessed John Paul II with Dr. Carson Holloway. To hear and or download this episode, along with many others, go to discerninghearts.com. This has been a production of discerninghearts.com. I'm your host, Chris McGregor. Join me next time for The Way of Life, Reflections on the Teachings of Blessed John Paul II with Dr. Carson Holloway.